This episode is sponsored by ByHeart. For a wide variety of reasons, not every mother can breastfeed. So we would like to introduce you to ByHeart, the only U.S.-made infant formula with globally sourced ingredients to use organic, grass-fed whole milk.
ByHeart features a patented protein blend that gets closest to breast milk. ByHeart's blend includes the most abundant protein found in breast milk, alpha-lac, as well as lactoferrin, the number one protein found in colostrum.
ByHeart is made with certified clean ingredients, no soy, corn syrup, GMOs, or palm oil. The formula includes prebiotics and an 80-20 whey to casein ratio, just like early breast milk, which is tailor-made for the newborn's digestive system.
Curious about ByHeart? Redeem your welcome offer at byheart.com/podcast with code DRESSED for a limited time. Additional terms and conditions apply. That's ByHeart, byheart.com/podcast, and use the code DRESSED.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Dress, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dress Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dressed, the History of Fashion, a podcast that explores the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, Cassidy Zachary
and April Callahan. Wake up, dress listeners. It's time to rise and shine for part two of our two-part episode this week, covering the dreamiest of fashion exhibitions, Sleeping Beauty's Reawakening Fashion, which is on view now through September 2nd, 2024, at the Costume Institute at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City.
Earlier this week, Andrew Bolton, curator in charge of the Costume Institute, joined us to speak about the exhibition's premise, which seeks to bring 220 objects connected by way of themes of nature to, quote, life by reactivating their sensory qualities and engaging visitors' sensorial perceptions through primary research, conservation analysis, and diverse technologies, end quote. This is an incredibly novel concept, as we spoke with Andrew about on Wednesday's episode, because it merges fashion's past with cutting-edge science. And we are going to hear more about that today from members of the collection and conservation teams of the CI. Because today we are joined by Associate Conservator Elizabeth Schaefer and Collection Specialist Bethany Gingrich to learn all about their roles at the Met and also about their work on this exhibition in particular. Elizabeth, Bethany, thank you so much for joining us on Dressed.
Bethany, Elizabeth, welcome to Dressed.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Well, I am very much looking forward to speaking to both of you today because this is part two covering the exhibition Sleeping Beauties, precisely because of the roles that both of you play at the Costume Institute. I'm hoping, first of all, that you could introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about those roles that you play at the CI and what a typical day might look like for you.
I guess I'll go first. Hi, everyone. My name is Elizabeth Schaefer. I'm an associate conservator, and I've worked at the Costume Institute for about 5.5 years. I am responsible for conservation advisement on loans to other institutions, as well as interdepartmental loans within the Met. And I also work on internal Costume Institute exhibitions like Sleeping Beauties. And I don't know that there's necessarily a typical day for me, since our work is so varied, but it could include condition reports, which are used to document an object's current state of preservation, both photographically and in writing, treatments to stabilize an object or improve its appearance, meetings about loan logistics, and many, many emails.
Yeah, and one of the reasons I'm so excited to talk to both of you is we want to lift the veil of sorts in terms of the major amount of work that actually goes into mounting a fashion exhibition like this. People simply do not know how many players are involved and how many different positions are involved in all this tremendous work that everyone is doing, including caring for the objects, Bethany.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, we love sharing what we do because it, like Elizabeth said, it is so varied. Sometimes it feels like you're in a weird fever dream, the work that we're working on. But my name's Bethany Gingrich. I'm a collection specialist here. I've been at the Met for about 5 years as well. I'm responsible for overall collections maintenance and care. With that, we sort of use that the overarching term preventative conservation. So we're not, unlike Elizabeth and the conservation team, we're not doing any active treatments, but we're primarily monitoring and providing maintenance for the collection. For my role specifically, I work on creating long-term storage mounts for the dimensional objects in the collection. And a typical day, it's hard to pin down, but it might include object movement. So tracking, pulling, returning objects into storage, facilitating appointments for external researchers or internal stakeholders, either monitoring the collection, as we're going through and pulling objects, if we encounter any issues, particularly with an individual object, or heaven forbid, with the facilities, we're on the front lines, we're the first to act. Another one of my responsibilities is packing objects to travel for loan. So I work very closely with Elizabeth on loan considerations. One of the things that I think is so great to highlight with this podcast that you're talking about, April, is the work that we do as a team. It's so collaborative. We're always consulting with one another, making sure we're sharing the workload and relying on each other to divide that labor. It's not typical of every museum that we have such a large staff. In some places, the role is of collections and conservation is one person. We're fortunate. So in many ways, the scale of the work that we do, it's necessary that we have such a large team, but we're very fortunate that we can rely on one another.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I guess I've never asked anyone this before, but how many lovely individuals is your team at the CIA?
I don't want to get this wrong. I think we're 22 at the moment. Is that right?
You're in the 20s.
We're in the 20s.
Yeah, yeah. And how many objects are in the collection?
Approximately, we like to say that we have about 33,000 object records.
Wow.
So that can include an ensemble that has six components, or it could be one hat. So it's a wide variety of actual numbers of objects.
Right, right, right. Well, I'm super curious from what you've told us so far about how your positions potentially switch into a different gear once the department begins to mount a new exhibition. Could you tell us a little bit about some of your initial duties in terms of getting Sleeping Beauties, this exhibition specifically, started? Because as we have established earlier this week in our conversation with Andrew, you know, this entire premise of the exhibition spotlights very much so the roles of both of your departments.
Yeah, I mean, this exhibition was a very significant undertaking. It was ambitious and exciting. And, you know, it follows that we have a very short timeline every year to put up these shows. And we just dive in as soon as the summer hits in the year prior. So we get the ball rolling as soon as we can. So our primary role in collections is to make the collection as accessible as possible to those that need to view or assess the objects. So as Andrew mentioned in his interview, the curatorial team goes through the database and will request specific objects that they want to see. So our role is to pull those objects, make them accessible for conservation, to assess their condition, and then allow a sort of viewing for these objects. So following those selections, we make sure that they can go to the lab for treatment, for example, or they go to installation to get dressed on a mannequin, whatever the next steps are for these objects. So for this exhibition, collections was also heavily involved in providing access to the objects for the data collection.
Yes.
Elements.
And we're going to get to that later, I think.
Yes. So this meant that we needed to provide external access for individuals, and only Met staff can touch the objects. So we're right there with the data collection process. And we also were working internally with other Met departments to make this happen. So a lot of moving objects around, but also within our job, we're making sure that we're tracking locations for these objects. So nothing gets lost in that process. Everything's being moved safely, and we're providing that that care while also making sure we get the information that we need.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's like I said, people don't realize how much work goes into all of this behind the scenes. Yeah. Elizabeth, what about your department?
Yeah, so when we received the preliminary checklist from curators, the first step for conservators is to assess the condition of the pieces. So we're looking for physical issues like open seams, abrasions, tears, losses, things that compromise an object's structural stability. And also we're looking for aesthetic issues like stains or fading, things that might affect an object's appearance so that it deviates from the original design intention. So after we examine all the objects, we can divide them into sort of broad grouping, objects that could be displayed with minimal work, treatments that might be longer, requiring many hours of sewing or more complex problem solving, or objects that can't be fully stabilized or brought back to good aesthetic condition, even with treatment. For most exhibitions, the last category would be objects we'd recommend leaving off the checklist. But for this one, it included pieces that we actually might suggest as one of the eponymous Sleeping Beauties that were displayed flat in vitrines instead of on mannequins. So these were objects that had some sort of intrinsic issue with their materials or construction that contributed to their deterioration and that we wouldn't normally consider displayable.
Yeah. And this was one of the things that was so exciting about this exhibition is it, and it's not just only in the case of Sleeping Beauties, it also applies to other garments that are in the exhibition as well. But as fashion historians, we have only seen some of these pieces in photographs before. And to see them in person and in real life and in 3D was very, very cool. So, Elizabeth, I'm going to direct the next question to you. Once this final curatorial selection was made for these actual Sleeping Beauties, the ones that, you know, could not be mounted on a mannequin for a variety of reasons, what were some of those conservation concerns that required them to be placed flat in the vitrines?
So I know that Andrew touched on a few of these pieces already in his interviews. So those were a Satinworth gown that had catastrophic warp loss that were not able to stabilize. He mentioned another Worth made of taffeta with metallic salt weighting that's causing the silk to shatter. And he talked about a McQueen jacket with splits forming between rigid and flexible areas of the fabric. So I will elaborate about a couple of others. The first example I'll give is a Sleeping Beauty with issues caused by its construction, one of the iconic Fortuny Delphos gowns from around 1920. So this particular dress and others like it were famous for their vertical pleating, which was made through a secretive process involving heat and pressure. And over time, the repeated flexing of all those many fine pleats eventually causes the fibers to break along the folds. And this can cause splits that quickly shoot down the gown in a really traumatic sort of way, especially when it's being stretched over a mannequin. So a flat orientation places next to no strain on the pleats. So this was really the preferable method for display. The second example I'll give is a Sleeping Beauty that had a problematic fabric finish, which was a 1968 sailor dress by Norman Norell.
Iconic in terms of his work, we must say.
Yeah. So although technically it's in good structural condition and could have been dressed on a mannequin, we displayed it flat to distinguish that it's an object we wouldn't normally show due to its appearance. So this exhibition is a chance to dig a little bit deeper into the collection and highlight these pieces that have never been seen before because of their condition.
Yeah. And that particular dress, it's white, and by and large, the majority of the dress itself is white. But because of some of the treatments to the organza, is it organza?
It's a cotton organdy.
Yeah, it has some what appears to be stains, but it's just the natural progression of time in terms of the fabric, yeah?
Yeah, so the organdy is starched. The starch itself, it's not the cotton fiber, but the starch has degraded to a really shocking, uneven brown color and totally deviates from the bright and crisp appearance that the dress should have. And there were a couple of factors that prevented us from treating it. So the starch is water soluble and could potentially be removed with wet cleaning, but the dress has a beautiful navy blue trim and the dye is also soluble and could be affected by dye bleeding during the treatment.
Yeah.
So the second is that the starch itself is really integral to achieving the look of the piece with bouffant sleeves and a large skirt, and removing it would change the silhouette and make it much more relaxed and floppy. Either it would be like that or we might have to restarch it. And both of these outcomes, changing the shape or having to like introduce a new material or reducing the color of the blue, those outcomes are tricky ethically, since we generally strive for minimal intervention and reversible treatments. So in this case, we decided it was best not to treat the dress and let it continue sleeping, if you will.
No, I mean, actually, when I teach American fashion history, I use that dress in my class. So I was very pleased to see it in person for the first time. One of my other very favorite vignettes from the exhibition was actually this pairing of two more or less identical Charles James butterfly gowns from 1955. So when you see them, you understand immediately why they're being displayed next to each other. But for our purposes, because we are on a podcast, which is audio based, what was the purpose of displaying those two gowns next to each other?
All right. So this pairing is one of the rare examples in the collection where we have duplicates of a particular style. And in this case, one of the gowns is heavily worn and the other is nearly pristine. So the Sleeping Beauty came from Charles James' studio, where it was used to promote his work and was later displayed frequently by the Brooklyn Museum before it was transferred to the Costume Institute in 2009, along with the rest of the Brooklyn Museum's costume collection. In contrast, the intact gown was worn only several times when it was new and then carefully stored by its original owner before we were fortunate enough to acquire it in 2013. So first and foremost, the intended comparison is visual so that viewers can really appreciate the differences between the Sleeping Beauty with its deteriorated, disarrayed, and frankly sad-looking chiffon and its intact counterpart. So in these gowns, for those who haven't seen them, there are a lot of factors that combine to produce a situation where the damage is basically inevitable. So they are built on this rigid understructure that cinches and molds the wearer's torso, and a pleated silk chiffon is stretched over that, which is conforming to the dramatic curves that are produced. But all of that manipulation causes tension in the fabric. And the pleats are further stressed by the sharp creases, as with the Fortuny. The chiffon has a delicate open weave structure, which is prone to abrasion from wear and handling. And then accumulated body oils degrade the fabric chemically. So we're showing both dresses simultaneously to highlight the different states of conservation. But also, we hope that under our care, with strict guidelines about display that limits exposure to light and environmental hazards and allowing for prolonged periods of rest or slumber between exhibitions, we're hoping that the public will be able to experience the intact butterfly gown far into the future and have it not wind up like its damaged sister.
Yeah. And this is the value of the work that you all do. And it is so poignant seeing these two dresses next to each other. You know, I've been doing this for a long time being a fashion historian, but that truly was one of my highlights of the exhibition. And actually, I was there with Marjan Arzaluz, who is the director of the Palais Galliera in Paris. And she's like, okay, We've already been through the exhibition, but can we go back and look at the two Charles James gowns again? And we did. We backtracked and went to see them again. Dress listeners, with our fashion history tours of Paris coming up, Cass and I have been brushing up on our French with Rosetta Stone. The language learning expert for more than 30 years, Rosetta Stone makes learning a new language quick and easy because you learn by immersion.
There are no English translations, so you really can learn to speak, listen, and think in that language. And their programs are available to use on your desktop or as an app. There's even a speech recognition feature that helps you perfect your pronunciation.
With 25 languages offered, including Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Dutch, Arabic, and Polish at your fingertips, don't put off learning that language any longer. There's no better time than right now to get started.
And for a very limited time, Dress listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today for 50% off, unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Cass, it seems just about anyone I ask these days has far too much on their plate or are actually going through some pretty major life changes. And sometimes it's pretty amazing to have some extra support from someone else outside of your inner circle. And that's why I turn to my therapist to help talk me through some of life's stressful moments, which is something we all experience.
Therapy isn't only for those who experienced a major trauma. It's a tool to support you in becoming the best version of yourself. And BetterHelp is here to support your journey. BetterHelp's licensed therapists are available to you online with convenient online appointments suited to your schedule.
Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Whether you want to understand interpersonal conflicts or just need a little bit of help focusing, BetterHelp is here for you.
Visit betterhelp.com/dress today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/dressed.
Menopause, perimenopause, these can be some of the most uncomfortable phases of a woman's life. If you find yourself in either of these, well, Hormone Harmony is here for you. Hormone Harmony capsules contain science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life.
Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And get this, Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it's perfect for those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold.
Hormone Harmony uses only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it shows. And the biggest benefit? Feeling like myself again, which is what women mentioned over and over in their reviews. And Cass, there are 17,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony.
For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DRESSED at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code DRESSED for 15% off today.
Bethany, by far and away, one of the exhibition's strong suits is also this very wonderful selection of hats. So many hats in the show. And you care for all of these hats. Could you tell us more about how hats are stored every day in the collections rooms versus how they appear in the show? And who is doing all of this mounting?
Yes, I love this question, particularly because the hats have a special place in my heart. I was first hired here as part of a hat mounting initiative for the collection. So I've created many of these hat mounts, but it's so exciting that we get to highlight accessories and hats in the spring exhibition, because it's not often that accessories, that, you know, their scale can pair with the size of a mannequin. So the fact that we were able to bring out so many, it was really, really exciting. We love to be able to share the amazing hat collection that we take care of. But your point about the difference between showing these objects in storage versus display is they're not too dissimilar, but there are differences that we select in creating storage mounts. So the things that are the same are we aim to protect the object from abrasion, from gravity, from handling. any movement that might happen in a gallery. And display mounts are all about presenting the angle of the object which best represents the object itself and complements the objects around it. So there's a much different principle in thinking about display. They're also meant to be invisible. They're supposed to blend into the exhibition design, not distract from the object itself. And the majority of these forms are fabricated by the mount makers in the mount maker studio, so a separate department from the CI. Storage mounting, on the other hand, is all created in-house. We're not concerned as much about how the mount looks. You know, it's not being seen by many people besides internal individuals. So we want to keep the mount as streamlined and neat as possible, but that sort of invisible quality, not so important. It's more about creating a sort of universal visual language in mounting principles. We want to make handling and removal from the mount as intuitive as possible. Theoretically, if the object goes into storage and is not moved again for another decade, we want the next collections manager, the next conservator, to be able to safely move the object without too much difficulty. Sometimes an object can appear intact and it may have a condition issue on the lining, may have something that's not quite as visible. So that information is super helpful to have prior to removing something from its storage mount. So sometimes we're leaving notes. Sometimes we're creating handholds or supports for a weak area, something to warn the next person what is going on with this object or what we've discovered about this object. Additionally, mounting objects in storage are less concerned about how the object is oriented, like display, the relation to the body being very important. We want the next person to be able to understand or comprehend the object as much as possible without removing it, but that might mean we're not mounting the object as natural as it would be for display. And then as for who makes the mount, I like to think of collections work as a cross-generational group project. So many, many people have had a hand in storing, in creating, in moving this collection. So the pieces that survive here are all thanks to that long line of collections managers. But we're constantly working to improve upon the status of these storage mounts. So the design philosophy may have become outdated. The archival materials might need updating. Maybe a new condition issue has emerged and the work is never done. We're always, always updating. So in my current role, I'm in charge of planning for and fabricating these storage mounts for all the dimensional objects in the collection. So this includes the hats, jewelry, shoes, but also large scale pieces that maybe need an extra support built in around them.
And one of the things I just have to say, listeners, is that every single object in this collection has its unique set of concerns, right? So we're not talking about just like putting a hat in an archival box, depending on the shape and does it have a veil or does it have these flowers or are these shoes that have straps? All of these little details are completely thought out when Bethany and team at the CI is creating these storage mounts, right? So all these little pieces are supported in different ways via all different types of archival preservation materials, essentially. Yes? Yeah. Did I get that right, Bethany?
Yeah, that's correct. They're all custom made to their unique concerns. And, you know, to add to that, the variety of objects that we have in our collection makes us really have to think on the fly with each object.
Yeah, there's a lot of care and love that goes into these, just saying.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another really special aspect of the show, and Elizabeth, this is something that you have already briefly mentioned, and Andrew went into a little bit more detail about earlier this week, but these scientific, quote unquote, I'm calling them interventions of sorts, that are interspersed throughout the exhibition. There was all this work that was done before it was mounted in terms of taking sound and scent recordings. There was radiography done to reveal the inner structures of some of the objects in the show, and also dye analysis. So might either one or both of you speak to some of your favorite examples of this in the exhibition, and how were your individual departments involved in this work?
Yeah, so I can speak to this one first. I particularly excited about the X-ray section in the exhibition, probably a little biased because of the hat. But it was quite an undertaking, even just to get what it looks like, one simple X-ray image behind each of these hats. It was quite involved. So the X-ray imaging was done in order to understand the internal structure of the birds themselves, whether it was taxidermied or sometimes not taxidermied at all. It was feathers pieced together, or a beak of one bird and a wing of another, kind of a macabre millinery techniques. But it also gave us more information about the use of wires and pins in the millinery itself, so that those all revealed themselves once they were X-rayed. So the X-ray process with these hats was done in collaboration with our objects conservation department here at the Met. They actually have an entire X-ray room dedicated to all the departments that can all have access to X-raying and getting more information about their objects.
This is super fun. I just love this so much. I did not know that there was an X-ray room with the Met.
This was new to us. Well, new to me as well. I think had thought, oh, how are we going to X-ray these things? It turns out, you know, we don't even have to leave the building. So our colleagues were so generous with their time and their expertise. We spent actual weeks working on these. We took multiple views of each hat to determine what was the best, what, you know, maybe didn't reveal as much as we thought it would. So there were many factors in why we had to take so many views. So again, it's that unknown. You know, you're collecting data, but you're not sure what the outcome is going to be. So some didn't quite reveal as much as we thought they might. We also had to take different views of and angles of the hat to sort of show how it would have appeared on the head. So sometimes we started with the front orientation, and then we started with the three quarters. So there was, that was multiple times, multiple processes. And then we also had the added factor of showing the best angle for the bird that's featured on these hats. When you're taking an X-ray of an object, you're essentially taking a three-dimensional view and you're flattening it to a two-dimensional view. So if you had, say, for example, one of the hats has two birds on it. So if you overlap the two birds in the right exact angle, you just end up with an unreadable blob. So we have to rotate just enough in order to make sure we can see everything in that view. And then the added element here is that with X-ray, the settings and intensities of exposure change what materials might appear in the view. So if the exposure is too high, it might blow out the metal. So it just reads like a big white blob. If it's too low, you wouldn't be able to see the feathers at all because, as we know, feathers are hollow. And so they're not going to show up as clearly. So it took many, many attempts to see what was the right exposure and what was going to show up on the view and what was going to show up in the image.
And that whole vignette was honestly like one of the most beautiful in the exhibition. I kept returning to it. I've seen this show multiple times now. I kept returning to it again and again. And I kept wanting to photograph it. But because they're behind glass, it's just, you just have to go and see it in person yourself to see how beautiful they are. It's not a photographable moment. So our objects have now been pulled out of storage. They have been put on exhibition. Once this exhibition is over, could you tell us a little bit about what each of your roles might be in putting them back to sleep as they return to extended storage?
Yeah, so once the garments are deinstalled and undressed, each will be carefully examined by conservators and compared to the reports and images that we prepared when they were first being considered for the exhibition to see if there's been any change in condition. So if there are any differences, we document the changes and update the records. And then the objects will be surface cleaned to remove any dust, which not only looks dirty, but can also speed up chemical processes that can cause deterioration. We use a special low suction HEPA filtered vacuum fitted with a tiny brush micro attachment to gently lift the dust away. And we really take our time to make sure we get every surface. So this is very calm, kind of meditative, long process. This is not like running a vacuum cleaner quickly over your couch.
Yeah.
And then for most objects, we take a sort of proactive step to combat any possible pest infestation. So these pieces have been out on display. They've been exposed to visitors that might have tracked something in with them. So the insects we're most concerned about are clothes moth and carpet beetles, which target protein fibers like silk and wool. But silverfish can also eat textile fibers. To kill any of those little critters that might be hiding or their eggs, we either freeze garments at very low temperatures for an extended period of time, or we treat them anoxically by sealing them in an enclosure where all of the air has been replaced with argon gas. And then there is another kind of subsection of objects that are kind of too large or cumbersome to put through either of these treatments, which will go through a quarantine process. Bethany, do you want to talk about quarantine?
Yeah, sure. Quarantine is a very passive activity, as you can imagine. The objects are boxed and then wrapped in plastic and sealed so nothing can escape. And then we typically leave them quarantined for about 3 months. This is sort of general life cycle of these pests. So after the 3 months, we're able to open the plastic, we open the boxes, and we visually investigate. We see if there are any signs of activity, if there's any adults or larvae, anything like that. And if that's the case, then we will remove that completely. It does not go back into the collection. We remove it and we'll do more intensive treatment from there. But once, say, the objects come back from a freezing process or an anoxic process or that quarantine, they all return to the collection. And that's really where collections work starts, is returning everything, filtering everything back into its original home location. We need to make space for the next exhibition objects to be reviewed. So we're sort of on that rotation and constantly returning things back. During this process, we also inventory and we update packing and storage materials for each object. So we make sure the object is safe and that we know where we can find it again. That's one of the, seems like a small factor, but it's very important when you're dealing with 33,000 objects.
I would ask both of you a very general question. I would love to know if each of you have a favorite piece in the exhibition, and or on the flip side of that coin, one that proved especially pesky for you when you were getting it ready to display.
Elizabeth, do you want to take this one?
Sure, I can start. So this is a really difficult question for me because I feel very close to all of the pieces that I treated or dressed. They're like all my children. So
yeah.
How do you choose? But I think one that I feel really connected to for this exhibition was the 1913 to 1914 Jean Halle hobble dress that we made a Pepper's Ghost for. So preparing this dress for exhibition had a ton of steps, and I was fortunate enough to be involved in all of them. First, I did some fairly routine stitch treatments to stabilize abraded areas of the metallic brocade fabric and trim, and to support the fragile chiffon straps of the interior foundation bodice. So these are pretty typical needs for a piece of from the time period. But then things deviated a little bit from the normal course of action, specifically for Sleeping Beauties. So I then reverse engineered a sewing pattern of the dress with a combination of tracing and measuring techniques as the first step to making the Pepper's Ghost. Then I gave the paper pattern to our extremely talented contractor, Ben Clemist, who made a reproduction of the dress using the closest modern fabrics you could find to the weight and drape of the originals, which is no easy task because they do not make silk like they used to.
Yeah.
But the results were totally gorgeous and looks just like a Halle. And I wish we could put it on display because it's basically identical, but in a slightly different colorway. He did such an amazing job. I hope we find something to do with it in the future to make it visible to the public. But I also digitized that pattern and then sent it to Nick Knight's team. And I think Andrew talked a little bit more about that collaboration. But we worked very closely together for the Pepper's Ghost. So they made a virtual version of the dress based on my paper pattern and then animated it with the help of a model actually walking around wearing the reproduction that Ben made so they could see how everything moved. Then for final tweaks about how the dress should fit and hang, I shared vintage photographs and advertisements with them for dresses and corsetry so that they could really understand the desired look. And then finally, I got to make the invisible mannequin for the dress out of buckram and then padded it out to the correct shape and stance for the period before dressing and styling the halle. So it's not like at a department store where you can put a clothespin on the back to make it fit. We actually build the mannequin out to fit the dress. We don't make the dress fit the mannequin. And I really enjoyed every step of this process and got to flex my fashion history and dressmaking muscles in addition to the conservation skill that I use more frequently. So it was really an incredibly rewarding experience. And so every exhibition we do is so varied and they all require slightly different preparation and skill sets. And Sleeping Beauties was particularly fun for me and matched really well with my interests. And I just feel really fortunate that I got to work with this dress.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you mentioned this one in particular because we did not talk about this beforehand. But like even seeing the work of Jean Halle is like so rare for us as fashion historians. Like, when I came and saw in that case and I saw it was Jean Halle, I literally went like this. I went, you have to be extra nerdy to know how special that was.
Yeah, I just really love the dress too.
Yeah, it's great. Super beautiful. And it's a hobble skirt. I mean, it's so great.
How much better can you get?
Honestly, though, having taken the paper pattern, it's surprisingly roomy. It's cut on the bias and draped. So that it has this really narrow taper to the ankles, but there's actually a lot of fabric in there.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Things you learn. Bethany, what about you? Do you have any pieces you'd like to talk about?
Well, I mean, just like Elizabeth, I do feel particularly attached to many of the objects in the exhibition. The collections team was responsible for laying the Sleeping Beauties in their vitrines. So we were heavily involved with each of those. So those are particularly special to each of us. But one of my favorite pieces in the exhibition is actually my favorite because it was especially pesky. It was especially difficult to make ready for display. It was the Elizabethan jacket from circa 1616. So as part of this process, I wanted to update its storage mount alongside its display mount. And I wanted to make the two of those things sort of be one and the same. So the storage mount could also be utilized in exhibition display. When we do this, it helps minimize the number of times an object needs to be handled in the future. But it also meant that unlike many of the invisible mounts in the exhibition, this piece is carved out of solid archival foam. The arms are articulated and the wrist mounts have an interchangeable sort of plug so that in the future they can be supported for long term. And during this process, it was such a great example of that cross-departmental collaboration that happens at the CI. I think everyone had a hand in making this mount happen. We worked together to analyze past display mounts. We consulted on its ideal silhouette for the era. We discussed condition issues and sort of past alteration. And everyone helped me problem solve materials and fabrication. So definitely a group effort on this one. And what might appear really straightforward in the shape of this object is actually a garment that came to the museum with many, many mysteries. So at some point, the seams were altered in the back panel, and it made it difficult to mount in a way that was legible. Yeah. So not only do I love a challenge, more importantly, working through the challenge and getting to the other side of it, but this piece was absolutely breathtaking in every way. So it feels so rewarding to be able to make it a little bit safer be able to look up close to all the details. The embroidery was absolutely stunning. Those dimensional pea pods, there's a bird carrying a caterpillar, just so finely detailed with this gold work. Just, I hope everyone who sees the exhibition stops a little bit in that room to look closely at it. But it's also being activated by that visual element as well as the touch display wallpaper. So it's very rewarding to both make the mount into completion and then also see it activated in that way.
Yeah. And just for our listeners, I'll post images of this, hopefully. But this entire jacket, which first of all, is one of the oldest pieces in the entire Costume Institute's collection.
Yes.
It's from 1616, is entirely covered with embroidery. Like the entire surface of this jacket isn't covered in embroidery. And the most perfect, beautiful, you know, obviously it goes without saying that this is all being done by hand at this time. So the amount of labor and effort and care and love that potentially one person or potentially multiple people poured into this garment is really super special. As is the fact that you all are still caring for it. So I know our time is about out today, but I just want to say thank you so much to both of you for everything that you did. This, I have to say, I think it's one of my favorite Costume Institute exhibitions of all time. So thank you to both of you and for, again, lifting that veil a little bit so our listeners can learn about all the work that goes on behind the scenes that they never see.
Thank you so much, April. I'm so glad to hear that you enjoyed it so much, and I hope that your listeners do too.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you so much.
Elizabeth, Bethany, thank you so much for joining us today to speak with us a bit about your work and the myriad of forms our collective work as fashion historians can take. You know, April, now we work mostly as public historians in terms of creating media content. But in the past, both of us have been stewards of major collections of fashion and fashion ephemera. And we, of course, both teach in person and online and have published several books. And we emphasize this just to say that a career in fashion history does not just have to be one thing. In fact, more than often, it is not. And there are so many ways to engage in our field. And that's really something we want anyone entering our field to consider or who's considering entering our field.
Also, for your consideration, go see this exhibition for yourself in person. Of course, as we mentioned at the top of the episode, it's on view now through September 2nd, 2024. So you still have time to see Sleeping Beauty's Reawakening Fashion for yourself. And if you're coming, and while you are there, perhaps you would like to also join me for a 90-minute fashion history tour of the Met's permanent collection. And that's where we're going to look at 10 of the Met's most fashionable masterpieces dating from the ancient world all the way into the 20th century. Typically, I do these only on Fridays at the moment, but if you guys want to schedule me on a day that you know that you're going to come see Sleeping Beauties, I can make that happen for you. You can find out more about my Met tours by signing up at dressedhistory.com. And if you want to shoot me an email about any of that, you can do so at hello@dressedhistory.com.
DressedHistory.com is also where you will learn about all the latest offerings in the dress universe, including my upcoming classes. I have the second class in my What Women Wore Revolution course, which will be covering the 1940s. You can still register for that class. And then on July 28th, I am bringing you a one-time lecture on Worn to Win, dressing the Summer Olympic athlete, because you all know how much I love the Olympics, and they're coming up. And also upcoming is our 500th episode, April, which is just amazing. And we are going to celebrate. Dressed is turning 500 in August. We hope that you will join us online on Sunday, August 11th at 6 p.m. EDT for a live free recording of the podcast featuring special guests. And you can register at dressedhistory.com.
I think that does it for us this week, dress listeners. May you consider how some of your heirloom treasures slumber away for future discovery in your closet next time you get dressed. We will, of course, be featuring many of the pieces discussed in this week's episode on our Instagram, and you can find the content related to these two episodes by heading over to @dressed_podcast and searching for the hashtags dressed497 and #dressed498. This is, of course, where you can also DM us if you'd like to write to us at @dressed_podcast.
Thank you, as always, for tuning in. More Dressed coming your way next week. Dress, the History of Fashion is a production of Dress Media.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.